All right, what's happening, everybody? Welcome to another episode of Let There Be Talk. It is June. Is it June? Yes, it is the month of June. June 8th, a Monday. And it is a metal Monday, I must say. It does not get any more metal than my guest today. Before I talk about him, I want to say real quick that this episode is brought to you by Molecule. Molecule air purification reinvented for every room in any home. All right, the guest today has been someone I've been trying to get on for a good 8 years, I would say. You know, I drew up a little list when I first started the podcast almost 9 years ago. Who do I want to have on? And Gary Holt was definitely in that list. Gary Holt is the king of the band Exodus, which I consider Bonded by Blood, their debut record, and a lot of people consider it the all-time greatest debut thrash record ever. And we could sit here and argue that over and over and over, but when I put it on myself, anytime, from the day I got the record to just a couple days ago, listening to it for the millionth time, it comes on and it immediately takes me back to the early 80s in San Francisco and that organic, insane, brand new scene that was just about to explode out of the Bay Area, the thrash metal scene. Of course, Gary Holt is the master riff writer and also incredible lyrics. It was great to have him on and talk all kinds of Exodus. Of course, I wanted to have him on during the Thrash January. And after seeing the film Murder in the Front Row and having the coffee table book, it was just incredible to see this band, especially in the documentary, just get its full glory. I loved it. I love this man, and I love that he has been playing metal, thrash metal, his entire life. The whole time in Exodus, and then for the last group of years in Slayer, filling in for when Jeff passed away, all the way to the last shows, which I saw the last two shows ever at the LA Forum. Great conversation today. We go all over the place. I'm just going to give you a little heads up. I wanted to just try to cover as much of the career of Exodus as I can without trying to sit on Bonded by Blood and the great Paul Baloff era too much. Of course, I could talk 2-3 hours with Gary about Bonded by Blood, but there's a lot of stuff, man. When Slayer needed somebody to step in, they went to this guy. So that's all you really need to know about street cred. Metal cred, whatever you want to call it. I can't thank you enough, Gary, for doing the show, and I can't wait to talk to you again already for a little part two when I do get up to Sacramento to do some comedy and get you down to a show and then another conversation. It was an honor to have him on, especially because he is a massive Prince fan like myself, and what a great day to drop this. It was Prince's birthday yesterday, so happy birthday to the all-time greatest Prince. That is right, the all-time greatest. I thought about it yesterday while I was sitting on the couch. I absolutely worship Zeppelin. I worship Metallica. Love me some Exodus. Love me some Grateful Dead. AC/DC. Of course, you guys know. I mean, that's my life. Judas Priest, all that. But really, man, at the end of the day, It's funny. If I had to pick one, I thought yesterday, it could quite possibly be Prince. And that is a heavy thought to me, because it would be like, well, yeah, Prince makes sense to me. It's you're going to get all kinds of different music. He's going to make you feel good. He's going to take you on a ride. All of them. Dirty Mind, Purple Rain, Sign of the Times, Diamonds and Pearls. I love them all. The Batman record. Anyway, happy birthday to the great Prince. And also, when you're done with this episode, throw on Bonded by Blood today and look at that sequence of music. Bonded by Blood, Exodus Attack, And Then There Were None, A Lesson in Violence, A Metal Command, Piranha, No Love, Deliver Us to Evil, Strike of the Beast. Man, and then go to YouTube and watch their live performance at Studio 54 on the Ultimate Revenge little old school VHS tape that I wore out at my house, me and a couple friends. By the way, I got to talking to Gary about injuries and everything, and from playing metal over the years, and I'm sure a lot of guitar players are tuned in today. And I'll tell you what, man, I've been using CBD Lion for a good 6 months now for my neck aches and my knees and my my wrists, all that stuff. CBD Lion. This stuff is incredible. THC free, so you don't have to worry about piss tests. Gluten free. Scientifically formulated, not tested on animals, third-party tested. This is not your truck stop bullshit. This is clean, real CBD. Unscented body lotions. I use the 900 milligram. I use the tinctures. A couple drops under the tongue during the day for a little anxiety. And they got the gummies, the topicals, and now they got the CBD patch, which I've been using. Stick the old patch on the neck, little slow release there. And I'm telling you, this stuff really helps. CBDLion.com, use the code DEAN for 20% off. Do it right now. They also got bath bombs. I'm getting into baths, I can admit it. I'll take a bath. I'm not afraid. I'm not a girly man. CBDLion.com. They also got tinctures for your pet. You got a lunatic pet. Give him a couple little drops. Let old Fido go take a nap. Go take a nap. Drip, drip. CBDLion.com. Use the code DEAN for 20% off. All right, before we do get to the episode, I want to thank the new Patreoners. There are 79 Patreon bonus episodes and incredible support from all the Patreoners. Stay Frosty, brand new Patreoner, the old shout out there, the Van Halen song. Chris Ekstrom, awesome. Sherman Greeley, Robin Martinez, happy birthday, girl. CVD, all right, good name. Dwayne Hoffman, Robin Yates, Evan Boyle, Tyler Hoffman, and Hazard Ground. Sounds like a band. Mark Zeno and Matt Pascarella, Hazard Ground, and Jim Mercury, or Mercery, is the Del Razor of the week. And if you do sign up for Patreon, I'm getting ready to do a couple free Q&A Zooms for all the Patreoners. A little Zoomy Zoom Zoom. By the way, this episode was done on Zoom, so sounds a little different, of course, than the high-quality Let There Be Talks you're used to. But it is the quarantine style. And I'm just glad to have Gary on. Fantastic human, man. Get ready for their new record. Eventually, they're getting ready to go track it here in the summer. And I can't wait to hear that. Little Zetro on vocals. All right, here we go. Gary Holt.
There he is on Let There Be Talk. Finally, Gary Holt. What's happening?
Not a whole lot, man. Just writing riffs and fucking staying safe.
Oh, my God. Hey, look at this shirt I wore for you.
Dude, you didn't even have to stand up. I recognize it by the top of the. You didn't.
Yeah.
Bay Area boy. I spotted that font immediately.
I know, right? The stone is such a, to me and you and everybody else, it is our CBGB, our whiskey a go-go, and it's so underrated, right?
Yeah, you know, it's like, I think a lot of us in the Bay Area didn't really appreciate it until it was gone.
Well, I think because if you think about it, you just thought clubs were just clubs.
And yeah, now, and we had a lot of them, you know?
When you look back on it, you're like, holy, I mean, this is the, other than Ruthie's, you know, it's the ground zero of thrash metal.
Yeah, one of them. I mean, if you want to go back to the beginning, you got to go to the old Waldorf.
Yeah, of course. Old Waldorf. I mean,
half of the people who went on to become titans of the Bay Area thrash scene had never walked in the door of that place. You had to be OG to be there.
I would just go on Mondays, Metal Monday, you know?
Yeah, and they had the Metal Monday and Best of Metal Mondays and then your basic regular rock shows and all that shit. You know, it was fucking rad.
Yeah, I mean, everyone played there. AC/DC played there on their first USA tour. And I would see Y&T there so much. They would run on those long tables with the wirelesses.
Yeah. Bands that I thought were going to be huge, like Hans Naughty and... Not Hans Naughty, no, sorry, that's a whole nother story. Head on,
I'm throwing the book at you. Remember that song, I'm throwing the book at you?
Yeah, exactly, Frank Wisely.
Yeah.
Bay Area's answer to Joe Perry.
Yeah, totally, and then Roadrunner, you know?
They were killer, they had all the hooks, they had the little singer who was super young and the girls went crazy for him and he had a voice and I thought they were gonna be huge.
It's pretty wild to think about some of those local bands, how good they were back then, you know, like Lamont's.
Violation.
Yeah.
Fucking Harvey and all these other bands and fucking.
Harvey,
dude. Fucking none. Yeah, there's so many bands. Yeah, it was so rad.
It really was, man. And those guys, Bobby Corona and Freddie Herrera that owned it, they were just pretty much golden, man. They just let us do whatever we wanted in there, you know?
Yeah, we got away with a lot of shit. especially before I was 21, you know, I was still drinking in most of these clubs, especially Ruthie's, you know.
Like, yeah.
You know, sitting at the bar and, God, I remember going to Ruthie's on dance night every Thursday night, you know, and there'd be nobody there. And so it was kind of like the Exodus little hangout. And we'd go there and hang out and just drink kamikazes. And then we showed up one Thursday and the place was packed because school had gotten out. And we were like, you guys have ruined our night. Fuck you. Get out of here. Like, you know, 400 people in there dancing to Duran Duran and shit. You know, like, this is just our quiet bar, our quiet place on Thursday nights. You know, like, and I was so sad when that ended.
Oh my God. That place is pretty epic, man. To think about. It's funny to watch Murder in the Front Row, you know, the documentary, because it really seems like a zillion years ago. It really was.
It was, yeah.
No, it's so long ago, but man, the impact in my brain of just memories of that whole time is just golden. I look at that and go, oh yeah, that film, you know?
Mm-hmm, yeah, I gotta watch it again. I got the DVD now, but I you know, it's like, I got to hook a DVD player up again. I haven't had one hooked up in so long. Everything's on demand or streaming, you know.
Yeah, DVDs are like, that's DVDs and CDs. I mean, do you have any CDs?
I still have thousands of CDs. I like having my CDs.
Wow.
I like having my DVDs. I just haven't hooked it up. And I'm lazy. Like, I'll buy albums in iTunes that I have because I'm too lazy to rip it in my computer, my phone up, transfer it over to my phone. I'll just hit my phone and just buy it. Yeah. And that's just sheer laziness. But I consider it okay because I'm supporting an industry I love and that needs some help sometimes, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I was supposed to have you on in January there for the Thrash January, but you had an injury. And I know that, you know, you and I have been talking back and forth because I had the neck and you were asking me about the place I went to, Lifespan Medicine. But over the years, it's pretty interesting the toll that metal has taken on people.
Yeah, especially the kind of metal I do, you know, like it's quite physical, you know, like I had 2 cortisone injections and 1 in each elbow just like a week and a half ago, you know, and but I'm able to play guitar right now pain-free, like, because, like, even the last European tour we just did, the February coronavirus tour, you know, I was in savage amounts of pain on that tour, just horrible. And, you know, then the neck and the back, I've had 3 epidurals, you know, and my knees are shot. All my joints are bad. You know, it is what it is. I wouldn't change nothing. I'm like, oh, I wish I could go back and not headbang and not jump off drum risers when I was younger, and then go beyond that and not skateboard, not crash on BMX bikes. You know, wouldn't change a thing.
I know. How boring would your life be, you know, if you just stood up on stage, John Entwistle style? You know,
yeah, I know. I mean, when my neck and shit is fucked up, sometimes I'm like, man, that would be so awesome. I guess I thought I'd be in a, I always joke, I thought I'd be in a country band by now, playing like playing in the background for like Garth Brooks or some shit, you know, big belt buckle.
Let's talk about, I got this couple tickets here. I went to the last 2 nights of Slayer there.
Yeah.
The first night to me was just, I was talking to Slagle about it. The set list was unbelievable the first night. Second night too, but the first night was blowing my mind. But Slagle thinks, and now it looks like it for real, that really was the last Slayer gig ever.
To my knowledge, to what I know, it's the last ever. You know, people say, oh, maybe they'll come back in a few years. I don't know. If it does, if it ever happens, it has nothing to do with me.
Right.
You know, it's like someone else would call and say, you know, we want to do this. But to my knowledge, it's done, you know, like, and I think it should be that way. The band went out fucking on a bang, went out on Slayer's terms. And how many people get to say they did that, you know? You know, everybody's happy doing their own thing. I'm happy as fuck, you know, not that Slayer made me unhappy. It's treated like family, but I'm back with my first family, my real family. Yeah. Not my step-parents. I'm back with, not my step-brothers. I'm back with my real brothers. And, you know, and that's where my heart is, and I missed it, and I was missing it more and more all the time.
Now, that Bay Area tour that you guys just did, Testament and Death Angel, the coronavirus hit all you guys. You got it, right?
Yeah, I got it. I tested positive.
Wow. Now, how bad did you have it? Was it like a long time or mild or?
I was pretty fucking sick for a couple of weeks. You know, like at first, you know, because knowing what Will Carroll went through, my first response was when I'd talk to people about it, it's like, oh, it wasn't that bad. It was like a really bad flu. Well, the flu fucking kills people.
Yep.
And the flu can make you wish you were fucking dead.
Yeah.
So I started thinking about it. Yeah, I was pretty fucking sick for like good 14 days. You know, it took so long to force the issue to get a test, and then the results took 10 full days, like the evening of the day 10, and by the time I got them, you know, I felt okay, I felt healthy again.
Right.
But yeah, it sucked. And then when I did feel good, it's like, all right, I feel healthy and go get some shit done around the house, and I'd like, damn, I'm winded as fuck in like 5 minutes of trying to actually resume activities. So it took me a little while to get back to normal, to where, like, you know, just bending over, like trying to like do a little yard work, just fucking send me right back to bed to sleep, you know?
Wow. Now, what were your symptoms? Did you have the cough or fevers or what?
I got off the plane from Europe, and the night before we flew home, we were waiting and for taxis, and we were at the place where gear storage, a big rehearsal complex, captured live in Germany. So, it's kind of an industrial area, getting a taxi. There's no Uber in that town. So we were outside. We're trying to go out for dinner, have a little steak dinner last night out, And we were waiting outside, and I started feeling like shit, like I was getting a cold. But, we were standing outside, and it was fucking freezing. We were out there for, 40 minutes waiting for this fucking car. So we eat, and I feel fine. But we also find out our food is taking forever to come, and then we find out the chef left sick.
Oh shit!
That night he had to leave. They went to the fucking hospital. All right. So the waiters are cooking food and all right, this probably is not good. That the guy in the back of this fucking restaurant we picked fucking ended up going to the hospital.
Jeez.
And but I felt fine the next day, and I get on the plane, and I felt fine. And then when I land, I'm like, I'm coughing a little bit. Fine. But, I figured it was just airplane air.
Of course.
I had to travel, by car from San Francisco to Sacramento. And just by the time I got home, I was feeling pretty shitty. Just nasty cough. Not horrible, but, enough to concern me. And then, woke up next day a little bit worse. And a couple of days after, I was pretty sick.
Wow. God, man. It's so scary, right?
Yeah, I mean, from what I knew, I wasn't that scared about it becoming something really bad because, I consider myself, other than all my joints are fucked, that my overall health is great.
Right.
But, it took Will down, and you never know. You can't assume that you're going to emerge unscathed, but I kept a close eye on my temperature and all that shit, and just laid there sweating, waking up just soaked, which is the worst part of ever being sick is waking up soaked.
Oh, the fever.
Fucked up, the pillows are wet, and I want to go back to sleep. And now, I'm getting up laying bath towels down on the bed to sleep on top. So I'm laying on something dry. It's,
wow.
Shitty.
And did your wife get it too?
No, she did not. And here's the thing. I'm convinced, when she tested, it said she was negative. But the test isn't always right.
Right.
I have a couple of theories. One, the test was incorrect because it's highly contagious. She was fucking sleeping next to me.
Right.
While I'm coughing all over the fucking place. And she also went on that Monsters of Rock cruise, the cruise ship, about the worst place you could be when this shit started. And I think she'd already got it and was asymptomatic the whole time. Although she did say she got sick for a little bit. She might have got it really mild. She might have had it before me, as far as I know.
Wow. Let's get into the early days of your music. I was watching the film, and I had no idea that Kirk Hammett taught you how to play guitar.
Yeah.
And that I had no idea on that. And it's just an amazing story, that young days of Exodus. Run me through that, man. You're hanging out with Kirk. He's basically, you guys are into metal, and then, boom, you start learning to play guitar.
We met briefly when Exodus played a little, post-after-school performance in Richmond High's music room. I knew Tom Hunting because he grew up across the park from me. I'd walk out my house, and two doors down is the park, and you'd walk across, and, in 90 seconds, Tom's house on the other side. But I didn't know Kirk, and first time I saw Kirk, they did Scorpions, Another Piece of Meat, and Kirk sang it. It was terrible. Maybe Tom didn't know the lyrics at the time because Tom was a vocalist and Tom could sing his ass off. But, yeah, it was pretty bad. But then we went to see Ted Nugent and the Scorpions.
Oh, at the Cow Palace?
Yeah, at the Cow Palace. And that's the first time I hung out with Kirk. And we met at his house over in El Sobrante, and he put on Scorpions' Virgin Killer for me, and I'd never heard Uli era Scorpions before. And I heard that solo on that and changed my life. That's why there's a whammy bar in fucking 99% of every guitar I got. And we just became super fast friends right from there. And after hanging out, and I was his roadie, I can't call it a guitar tech because all I did was help carry his 212 combo in, and while he's carrying shit, and drink, and then we tore it down. And so I wanted to learn a couple of guitar chords, and first thing he taught me was some Rolling Stone song. I can't remember what it was. But then he taught me like the basic blues lick, you know, band, 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 and shit like that. And 6 months later, I was in Exodus. So.
Wow. What was your first guitar?
My first guitar was a Gibson Gold Top copy, but not a real one. I saw you get all excited there. But
a Seville or a Memphis?
I don't remember what it was, but it was part of the infamous Exodus stolen gear heist.
Oh, shit.
You know, Exodus, a bunch of boys from the ghetto, and we needed better gear, so the band stole it.
Oh!
We got caught for that shit, so that got recovered and taken away from me. I traded a skateboard to Kirk's brother for it.
Wow.
Because this kid wanted a skateboard, and he had the guitar, and I didn't have it very long before the whole gig was up. And so then my dad actually bought me my Hondo Strat that I played for years.
Oh, yeah.
Back of Bonded by Blood on the live shot. And I had a friend tap out the threads and made me a thicker, bigger whammy bar like Uli's. You know, I wanted a bigger, not the little fucking Fender one. I wanted this big fucking piece of rebar damn near. And put a humbucker in it, and I played that thing for years. I would trade a very expensive guitar to have it back. But I smashed it up at New Year's Eve at the Bill Graham Civic.
Oh, that was a great night, man.
Traded the body, the broken pieces after the show for an 8-ball of cocaine.
So. Love it. I love it. That's funny. I love, you know, I was talking to Kirk a little bit about the drug days, and then I realized, you know, I think I'll talk to Gary about it because it's really more Gary's usage, but there was a lot of speed going on back then, man. I remember hanging out, and it was like, I think without any, like, speed meth, there would be no thrash metal.
Well, you know, when people talk about, oh, there's so much speed done, you know, it's actually way overestimated. Like,
yeah.
The band, we would party, and we'd get wired, but we would, like, get a half gram, and the whole band would get wired out on all night, you know?
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't that much. You know, it was mostly alcohol. And actually, the speed just kind of kept us drinking longer.
That's what it was about.
Yeah. It was like in the 90s when we were doing it. That's when we were smoking that shit.
Oh, you were smoking it?
Oh, yeah, yeah. And that's when the consumption got huge, you know, like just half gram. That's what you dump in the fucking pipe, you know?
Wow. I couldn't even imagine smoking that shit. It's so powerful.
Yeah, it's pretty powerful, yeah. The first time I ever smoked it, I looked at my friend and I said, wow, you know, because I always never did it. I just, like, snorted it.
Yeah.
And I tried it and, like, well, I could get used to this. Famous fucking last words, right? You know.
How long did that last? Did you smoke it for a while and then go, I got to get the fuck out of this?
After Bailoff died, it still took me a few more months, but I got clean in December 2002. So, and that enabled everything I'm doing today is because of that choice, you know.
You still drink?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm drinking during the happy hour tonight.
So once you're in Exodus, you know, Paul, I always look at Paul Bailoff as a Bon Scott type of person where they were completely unique and a front man, and like Rollins would say, they wouldn't be able to do anything else in life if they weren't a singer.
You know, there was like a long stretch where Paul wasn't a singer, but he was living in Monterey at the time when we reunited in 97, he was living in Monterey and he would like build sandcastles for the tourists and shit.
Really?
Yeah. He's living down there and just living like this vagabond beach life, you know?
Wow, I never knew that. What made him land down in Monterey?
A way to fucking find some kind of life that didn't require a job.
Yeah.
You know, I guess because, you know, he was solely suited to being a thrash metal frontman. You know, he wasn't suited to fucking go get a day job. He wasn't cut out for that. You know, he's not meant to, like, cut his hair off and, you know, go work anywhere. You know, he's meant to be Paul fucking Bailoff.
Unbelievable, that guy. I mean,
yeah. When he came back to Exodus in 97, he was living in this little Airstream trailer.
Oh, rad.
He sold it to two different people and bounced out of town.
Oh, in Monterey, you mean?
Yeah. Like, I guess two different people showed up to tow it away. Like, what? I bought it off him. No, I bought it.
Oh, my God. Classic bailoff.
So bailoff. Someone paid for it, and then someone else come up, well, I've got cash for it now, and he didn't say, I sold it already. He said, okay.
Oh, shit. I remember going to a party with you guys, me and my buddy Steve McDonald, and it was over in Berkeley, like in the flats or whatever. So one of your guys' houses or whatever, and this fork war broke out where you guys were all stabbing each other with forks.
Yeah, we've done that a few times.
Oh, my God. I was like, what the hell is going on here?
I remember we were at a house party in Berkeley somewhere, and up on this shelf about at least 8 feet up in the 8 feet high was this one of those, you know, the little geisha dolls. You used to see them in people's houses.
Yeah.
And stuff. And I couldn't do it again if you gave me a million tries. And first try, I took a fork, and I flung it as hard as I could and buried it right in that geisha's chest, dude.
Wow! Like,
yes! And I could never do it in 1,000 tries. Not in 1,000,000 tries. It was just the most luckiest of lucky shots. And it had to be the first shot was lucky.
Oh, my God, dude.
I wish I had a video camera back then, you know, but now everybody has one in their pocket.
When you guys, you know, start playing and you know, the draw gets pretty good, like, fast style, man. Like, you guys get popular. Like, I was going to shows, and they were full. How quick do you get the record deal from when you guys get up and rolling with Paul and everything?
Well, we got the record deal pretty fast, but there was a, you know, a well-documented, like, year delay after recording the album to actually get it out. Because we signed with a brand new record label, and it was basically two fans, you know, starting their own thing. And we were all their growing pains, you know, like, you know, kind of one of those things, like, had we signed with someone, like, you know, more ready to go, you know, we would have had our album out, like, right, you know, on the heels of Kill 'Em All and all that, you know, and then we wouldn't have been behind anybody. Because, you know, in the timeline of thrash metal, we're in front of everybody. But you know, it is, you know, I don't waste any time on regret. I think regret is just a backwards way of thinking. You know, it's just like putting your feet in sand and trying to move forward, you know. I wish I did this. All I can do right now is just keep going, you know, and make crushing records and not worry about, you know, who's in the big four, big five, big six, or whatever the fuck you want to call it nowadays, you know?
Yeah, that stuff's dumb, you know? It's like just to think about what ifs and all that. I don't subscribe to that.
I prefer losers. I mean, I've done a lot of shit that falls firmly in the category of losers. Drug addict, fucking, you know, all that shit. But, you know, I don't dwell on it. You know, it's like, it is what it is. You know, you learn from your life's experiences, and, you know, and I learned a lot. I'm still learning, you know, like, I'm still learning shit that I should have known a long time ago.
Yeah, I hear you, man. And I think as you get older, you're willing to listen also and to learn, you know what I mean? Instead of being like, nah, you don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, exactly. You listen and you also pay attention, you know, when we're younger, you know, like, we didn't bother to learn where our money was really going or any of that shit. You know, we just, where's the backstage? Where's my vodka?
Yeah. Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Not like, well, what are the, you know, can we sit down and go over the tours, like grosses and all that shit. I got my monthly salary, you know, partied, and I didn't question the rest, you know?
Yeah, it's funny now because as you get older, thrash is it's huge right now again. And now you can really look at it as like, okay, let's figure out it's as a business, you know, instead of just like, I'm not out this party, and it's like, this is, I'm going out to work.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it is a business. And yeah, sure, I miss the days. Yeah, I don't miss the days of like, not knowing where my money went. I miss the days when there was no money. you know, playing backyard parties for free beer at my friend's house for his birthday. That shit was fun because there was a, like, there was a innocence of youth there because we were 17 years old and playing heavy metal and just like getting drunk or smoking weed and talking about everything we were going to do in the future, you know, and that was a magical time, you know?
Oh my God. The Bay Area during then is just beyond magical time. There's just clubs all over. There's bands all over and there's fans all over, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
I think that 89 earthquake kind of wiped out the San Francisco music scene for a long time too, because it took down that Broadway Embarcadero part of the freeway. And you could no longer just get up on Broadway in minutes. It became a nightmare.
Yeah, it did become a nightmare. But I think the owners of the clubs just decided they're just going to cash out. You know, the Stone became what? A strip club for a while, right?
Yeah, yeah. You know,
Keystone Berkeley is like a King Coast copy or some shit like that.
Wow.
You know, and even places like, you know, the Berkeley Square is some kind of little furniture store now.
I also think that those clubs towards the end, people just weren't going anymore. Other things were happening, like raves hit the Bay Area hard.
Yeah, the rave scene, that sucked Rick Hunold in hard.
Yeah, was he into it?
You should see the guy dance. He was a master at it.
Really?
I've seen that dude. We were in Italy somewhere. We went out to some bar and they started playing some fucking music.
Yeah.
And he had a crowd around him as he was just soaking sweat, just fucking, just going for it like a gangster.
Wow.
So he can dance. Rick Hunold can dance.
That fucking combination of you and him playing the guitars is just so amazing to me, you know?
It's something special.
What's he up to?
Rick, he's up in near Clear Lake up there, and he's kind of a little farmer and taking care of his kids and shit. And I talk to him all the time, close as ever. Still like the best guitar player on earth. Lead guitar wise, he's always better than me.
Yeah,
it's just ridiculous how good he is.
Is he just working a job or?
He's working a job. He's a farmer.
Oh, all right. I get it now. I'm like, huh, what?
Yeah, a farmer up north somewhere.
That's great, man. That's a great gig.
I don't know if I'm supposed to say that.
Yeah. I mean, it's legal now.
It's legal now. Everybody's a fucking farmer.
Yeah.
Molecule. Air purification reinvented for every room in your home. Molecule is reimagining the future of clean air, starting with the air purifier. It's not just an improvement on existing outdated technology, but a complete reinvention of air purification. Molecule's core technology, PECO, or photoelectrochemical oxidation, was developed to actually destroy harmful pollutants in the air, like VOCs, bacteria, mold, and viruses, instead of just collecting them on some old filter. That technology is out. This is brand new, state-of-the-art stuff. Are you dying from allergies? I know. I can't even believe this allergy season that's going on right now. My ears, my head plugged up. Ugh. Molecule has reinvented the air purifier to destroy airborne pollutants, including allergens, bacteria, mold, viruses, and volatile organic compounds. It's going to help you, man. Get it in your house, put it in your room, turn it on, and watch the difference. HEPA filters, those old things, they haven't been updated in 70 years. This is new state-of-the-art stuff. Molecule destroys pollutants that other filters just collect. Come on. You need to get a deal right now. I'm going to get you a deal on one of these. Get it. Use the code DELRAY, DELRAY, 10% off your first air purifier order. Visit Molecule, MOLEKULE.com. And at the checkout, use DELRAY. I'm telling you, this thing is amazing. Get with it. Molecule. Man, I can't even tell you how much it's helped me. Air purification for the whole home. Molecule now offers our breakthrough Pico technology across a range of products, providing a solution for the entire home when it comes to air purification. Perfect air in your hut. Whether you need the Molecule Air for large rooms or the Molecule Air Mini for smaller rooms, you can now choose the unit that best suits your space. Create a bundle to provide an air purification solution for your entire home. Code is Delray, 10% off Molecule, MOLEKULE.com, molecule.com. Get one of these people. It's helping me out. This allergy season is brutal. Cleaner air is healthier.
Once you guys get the deal, what made you choose Prairie Sun to do the record? I recorded there tons. I loved Mook up there, the owner. Hey, Bubba! You know, they had those weird little cabins, man, and the studio had something. It was just that old chicken farm, man.
Well, we chose it because Mark Whitaker found it, and he liked the drum room, you know, the big drum room. And it's a great studio. And we got to live there, and by live there means we recorded during the day and we wreaked fucking havoc at night.
Totally.
Partied so fucking hard, and like friends would come up from the Bay Area, next thing you know, there's fist fights happening and shit, and it was nuts. And we went back in 2003 to do the drum tracks for Tempo of the Damned there, and I had to have a personal phone conversation with Mooka that this isn't going to happen again.
Wow.
Well, he was just nervous, like, man, you know, like, I said, no, Mooka, come on, we're fucking, like, 20-year-old kids. We're not going to fucking wreck the place. And he said that we wreaked the trail of destruction so great it had to be admired. but when we went back, though, we left it cleaner than we got it.
It's so funny because when you're up there, what people don't understand, you're just basically kind of on a side road off in Cotati, California. And you're on a farm, and at night, there's no one up there. And you could just be going crazy, man, and nothing.
Yeah, drinking vodka and Schaefer beer.
Schaefer beer. The sport pack.
The fish on it, you know.
The sport pack. Yeah. Oh, that shit, you drink them all and not get buzzed at all.
But, you know, we've, like, our last several albums, we've kind of replicated that whole Prairie Sun vibe, you know, by doing it in different locations. But we, you know, we do the drums in a regular studio. There's so many channels and mics, but we're not on the next one. But we've done when we did Exhibit B, we rented a big vacation home up in up not far from Guerneville in Russian River area.
Yeah,
and built the studio there and lived there and recorded. And we've done it in other studios, and we're doing it again on the next album because we like the summer camp vibe.
Well, you get focused, you know.
You get focused. One guy gets tired, and you still got usable hours in the day. The next guy goes. You know, you're all there. And if I'm not doing solos and Lee is, you know, I'm manning the barbecue grill, and it's fun, and we get to live the album. You know, it's like. Other bands have done it like that. I remember Red Hot Chili Peppers did an album. They rented a house and lived in it and recorded. And
yeah, the mansion in Laurel Canyon.
Did an album in the Sharon Tate house, you know. We just tend to go out in the woods somewhere, you know.
Well, that's a good spot to do a record, man. You know, especially these days. You got to get away from the phones and outside.
Get away from the phones, traffic. You know, you get to the studio, you get stuck in some horrible gridlock, and you're already stressed out when you got there. Instead of waking up with a cup of coffee in your hand and you're tracking, you don't even have shoes on yet, you know?
Yeah.
And Tom, you know, a drummer, he bought a house up in Lake Almanor, up past Paradise up there.
Oh, wow.
And,
Chico
and
shit?
What's that?
By Chico?
No, way past, about an hour and a half north of that, up in the mountains, you know?
Wow.
And so we're going to do the album at his new place.
That's where he's living, huh?
Yeah. He splits time between there and the Bay Area.
How long did that record, Bonded by Blood, take to record?
I think we did it in like a couple of weeks.
Yeah.
2 weeks or some shit like that. I don't remember. We were drunk the whole time.
Yeah.
Not during the day, but yeah. I think we're like 2 weeks. You know, things were rushed back then. You didn't have like 2 months or even a month. You know, I think the whole thing was tracked in probably about 14 days.
Who produced that? I can't remember.
Mark Whitaker.
Who
was
yeah.
the manager at the time as well, you know.
And who was the engineer? Was it like Steve Fontana up there, one of those?
A guy named John Velitis.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, funny guy. He fit in perfectly.
Ah. Now, what about the album cover, man? It's like one of my favorite covers ever. It's like that movie, It's Alive. But
not even the first album cover. The first album cover was done by Tad Hunter, who was one of like Ken Kesey's Merry Pranksters and all that.
Oh, yeah.
And we didn't like it at first. And then we did like it, but then the label thought, oh, they're not going to, you know, let us do it. And it was kind of weird. And then we had some other ones, and it was originally called Lesson in Violence. And it had like silhouettes of us with all these body parts and shit, you know?
Oh.
So I came up with this idea for the Bonded by Blood one. And, you know, this is before the days of digital art and internet, you know, so, you know, it wasn't like we had time to go back and forth. It's cool. Let's change this. What you see is what you got. That was it. I'm like, all right, cool. I wouldn't have chose a baby blue background, but now it's iconic, you know, so.
Oh.
What the fuck, you know?
It's classic, man. I met AC/DC backstage at the Cow Palace on the Flick of the Switch tour, and I'm wearing a Bonded by Blood shirt in between Angus and Brian Johnson. I'm just there, man. And every time I see it, I wore that shirt everywhere. I love the cover. I love that one. And I love the Sabbath Born Again cover with that crazy baby.
Yeah, yeah. So do I. I think it's great. And then years later, it wasn't Van Halen ripped our babies off.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, they have an album with the good baby and the bad baby. You thieving bastards. Eddie, yeah. If I hadn't stolen so many guitar licks from you, I'd be mad. Touche. I had that one coming because, yeah, I learned a lot from you, Eddie.
I'm so glad. I must have watched it a million times, but I'm so glad that VHS was recorded, the Slayer, Exodus, Venom one, you know?
Yeah.
Studio 54.
Ultimate Revenge.
Yeah, Ultimate Revenge, man. That is there any extra footage on that actual?
Whoever, you know, Sony, if they even know where it is, yeah, the whole show was filmed.
Oh.
I mean, ours, so there's extra songs because the whole show's not on there.
Right.
Same goes for Slayer, I'm sure. Venom, they didn't use the live footage. They just used their music videos.
Yeah, that was dumb.
Well, probably they looked at the live footage and said, we can't use this. But, you know, that's the beauty of Venom, was the slop and the gnarly fucking wall of fucking fury. It was killer. But then if you did, and when you're there, it was rad, and you listen back to the live recorded masters, it probably like, oh, well, no. Fix everything, you know? Like, so, you know, yeah, we were all surprised. Like, why don't they have their footage from the show? But it's fucking legendary night, you know?
Oh, my God. It really is, man, in that legendary room. I love at the time they're lighting the Saturday Night Fever poster on fire at the beginning of it. And at the same time I loved Exodus, I loved the Bee Gees and Saturday Night Fever.
I still do.
I do, too. And that's what I love about you, because you have pretty eclectic music taste like myself. You're way into Prince and all that, and it's funny that back then some people wouldn't admit that they were into something like Purple Rain.
Yeah, I'm sure there's a lot of people went in there, and there's also a lot of music that I didn't like back then and I love now, especially the whole new wave era shit. Like, don't get me started on some Kaja Goo Goo, you know, I love that shit, you know, fucking Soft Cell and fucking
Soft Cell, Tennessee.
I love that stuff. But I've always, you know, I grew up in Richmond, California, and I was surrounded by Parliament, Funkadelic, and Ohio Players, and fucking Brothers Johnson and Isley Brothers and shit. So I love that stuff. I still do. You know, I listen to that shit more than I ever do heavy metal.
Yeah, same here, man.
One of my favorite albums of all time. I mean, I got all these favorite albums. You're like, what? You're like Terrence Trent D'Arby, you know, Hardline. It's like one of my favorite albums ever made.
Dude, I saw him two times, man. I saw him on that tour at the Warfield.
I saw him at the Warfield.
Yep, sign your name on the dotted line. Then I saw him on the Vibrator tour at the Fillmore with no one there, and it was one of the greatest shows I've ever seen.
I mean, you know, I was at the Warfield, then I saw Lisa Stansfield there. Greatest shows ever.
Wow.
And, you know, we were managed by Bill Graham manager back then, and like, you know, you want to meet her? And I was too embarrassed. I was like, oh, man, I don't want to meet Lisa Stansfield. And I was like, no, that's okay. I don't want to.
Oh, man.
That was right after the fucking Round the World and all that shit. And that album came out, you know, fucking epic.
Did you, how many times have you seen Prince? Have you seen Prince?
Seen Prince about 6-7 times.
Yeah, same here.
Including still saw him at the DNA Lounge, you know.
Same here, yeah.
And first time I ever saw him, though, like, you know, I've been posting on Instagram albums that changed my life, and people keep asking about Prince, but I'm not putting him in there, even though he's my favorite, because it was a concert that changed my life.
Right.
At the Warfield. Of course, I heard Prince, and you know, I knew, you know, the music and stuff, and I liked it. But then me and Rick Hunold went, and the show was announced the night before, sold out in like 10 minutes, you know. And we were seventh row center, and it was Prince, and he had Sheila E., and he had Jerome there.
Yeah.
Fucking the whole revolution, and it was the gospel. I'd never seen anything like it. I'd never seen music commanded like that. Fucking just, it was like James Brown and the Beatles and fucking Parliament and everything all wrapped up into one. It was fucking the best concert I've ever seen.
Yeah, I mean, it's, and they're all playing, you know, a couple of weeks ago, they threw up a full concert from his hometown on the Purple Rain tour. And, you know, I saw all these tours back then. I loved Prince, man. Sign of the Times is a masterpiece to me.
Good album, yeah.
Oh my God. Ballad of Dorothy Parker, Starfish and Coffee, or, you know, Housequake. But I saw him, man. And then I was watching this concert a couple weeks ago. It was like a Saturday night free thing to help for the lockdown. And you just can't even believe how fucking, not just him, but the other people in the band, the Doctor, Lisa, Wendy, all, I mean, I can't get over it. Now you have, your wife got you one of Purple Rain.
Yeah.
Now who made that?
Schecter built them for the Prince Estate. And like, so she ordered me one for, I think it was for my birthday. It took so long to get it, I kind of get confused on what the gift was for.
Wow.
You get something near your birthday, but it took forever, and it was supposed to come last November, and I don't think it came till February of this year, and she ordered it in the summer last year.
Wow. How's it play?
Plays great. I'm still setting it up a little bit, but right now I'm kind of in, like, writing mode. Sounds great. Plays killer. So I got, like, my number ones out right now, you know, like, it's easy to, like, flood the couches with guitars because I do it all the time. Like, you know, you can't sit down because there's just guitars leaning against all the furniture.
Yeah. Well, each guitar kind of, it you pick one up and something comes out of it, you know, and you're like, wow, all right. And then you grab a different one.
I was just pulling guitars out looking for that one, you know, and I've been playing this new Gibson V I got that is just amazing, and it's a fucking rhythm.
I saw that thing. It's great.
But then yesterday I was pulling out the Les Pauls, and like, these are great, but they're just not that one. But then I pulled out my 1984 Yamaha SVG 3000.
Oh yeah.
That's the one. That's the best guitar I own.
That's like the Dave Metichetti one.
Yeah, exactly.
What color's yours?
Like ivory, like aged white.
Oh man, how long have you had that?
Maybe about 6 months ago or something. It's showroom new. It's barely got a scuff on it. No buckle rash, nothing.
It's got the abalone inlay all the way. Oh, my God. What year is it?
84.
84, the year I graduated. The year Bonded by Blood came out.
No, 85, so it's even a year older. It's just the most in-tune sounding guitar. It just is perfect. But the stock pickups were so clean, like no gain at all. Jazz guys covet them. So EMG made me a set of passives that look like the stock ones because I didn't want to change the look. So it sounds amazing.
Wow. Where'd you get that? eBay?
A guitar store I follow on Instagram up in Seattle.
Shit, what a score.
Yeah, I bought it that the second I commented. How much? Mine.
How much was it?
$3,000.
That ain't bad, man. I had Dave Medichetti on the podcast, and we went through the history of his SGs, Yamaha SGs, and he told all about it because, I just remember he just played that black one with the 3,000 fully, all the abalone and everything, and it was just unbelievable.
Well, the first guy I ever saw who had one that made me want one because his tone was so killer was Thane Rasmussen from Anvil Chorus.
Oh, wow.
He had one back in the old Waldorf days, and like, what an amazing guitar. I'm playing this Hondo, and I've got this big fucking oversized stainless steel whammy bar, and it's a cheap guitar, but I made it killer, and like, he's got this beautiful guitar, and it sounded so killer. And this thing's amazing.
You think he had changed pickups on his back then?
No, because I mean, some of them came with your basic PAFs in it and stuff. Like the one I got didn't, but it's just so good.
Wow! And the color, cool.
I put the other guitars away. So the other thing I was going to say, my SVG 3000 is better than Kirk's.
Oh shit! He's got one.
Yeah, well, we both love him, and he sent me a picture a long time ago, like a couple of years back, and like, look what I just scored, dude, and like a really sweet black one, and then I sent him mine, and like, look at mine, I sent him a picture of the back, like no one's ever played it with a belt buckle on, it's like perfect.
Oh my God, I wish I could see it. You got it right there?
Yeah, hold on.
Yeah, oh my God. Oh, dude, that thing is killer.
There's not even a fucking... a mark on it.
Dude, look at that thing.
Showroom there, dude.
Oh, my God. Oh.
Not a scratch. The headstock doesn't have a single chip on it, although it might since I just tagged it on the shelf.
Oh, my God. Oh, that thing is beautiful, dude.
Yeah, it's fucking great.
Oh, my God, that is a score. It's so funny. I've been talking about those guitars for years on my podcast, and then there you got one. And Kirk,
no, they're amazing. Well, I had one of the cheap ones.
Oh yeah, those suck.
Back in the '80s, the one they made with a whammy bar, and I played it like on almost all the tracks on Pleasures of the Flesh, and it was just solid black one color. And I took some white pinstriping tape from the auto store and made binding on it. Which was cool. It looked great. It gave it that look like it had it had a surround, And I love that guitar. And I always wanted one of the good ones, so I'm stoked. This, like, when my world in metal is done and I'm just an old guy playing for fun at a bar, That's one of the guitars I keep.
Yeah.
Like my wife was like, really? And I'm like, yeah, if I was like paring it down to just keeping like 3 or 4 guitars and make myself happy and shit, that's one I hang out with.
Let's talk a little bit. You and I grew up in the Bay Area, and I talk a lot about Dan the Greens. How many of Dan the Greens did you go to, and how monumental was it to you? Because to me, it really just game changer in my life.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, fuck, I can't even remember how many I went to because, I never saved all my ticket stubs. I mean, I do have like a keepsake folder in a Rubbermaid tub with a bunch of that shit in it. But yeah, I went to a bunch of them, like fucking every summer. That's what we did. Saw Bon Scott there and fucking.
Yeah. Yeah.
And fucking, what was it? Livewire? Yeah. Seeing Thin Lizzy there with Gary Moore and Ted Nugent and Journey and Black Sabbath with fucking Dio and Nazareth and Mahogany Rush and fucking Aerosmith and everybody else, just countless bands, and for what, like $10?
Yeah, yeah. and the time of your life.
Time of my life, dude. We'd smoke like a ounce of weed before we ever got in the building.
Yeah.
So, back when you'd ride down the freeway in the back of your friend's pickup truck and no one cared. And we'd meet at like 7 in the morning and everybody had that one friend who was passing out in line already. We had one too. Like, we'd park them in the seats and leave them there and come back at the end of the day and collect them. We just sunburned. We just left them alone. Kansas, seeing them there, and fucking Gamma.
Gamma. Now, that's what I wanted to talk to you about, because you put up Gamma 1 as one of your records, and Gamma, I think, is one of the greatest bands ever out of the Bay Area.
Oh, easily, easily. Those first two albums are as good as it gets.
It's unbelievable. The difference between Montrose with Hagar and then Gamma. Gamma is so violent and dark and heavy. It's incredible. Yeah, yeah.
Well, it's, you know, one of my favorite Montrose albums is the Warner Brothers Presents record.
Right.
Post-Sammy.
Right.
It's a darker, more metal record. It's like fucking super metal. And Gamma continued on from that with that, you know. I remember one of my favorite concerts I ever saw was Gamma at Valancourt Plaza on the free concert series in the summer in San Francisco.
Wow.
You know, when they they'd set up the flatbed trailers and put on the free shows there. Fucking, and that was just rad. You know, we were just front row against the trailer and just, yeah.
Dude, Ronnie was so amazing. I would see Gamma like all the time at the Phoenix Theater in Petaluma, and I'd just be front row. He had that Strat with the Bill Lawrence pickup that would move up and down. Yeah, you know, yeah. It was routed, and he could slide it up and down. And they would just come on, you know, and they play like, you know, Ready for Some Action.
Yeah.
And sure. You know, Fight to the Finish. And then the Voyager is just a tune, man.
Dude, that's on Leash, so fucking heavy.
Oh,
man. Dude. Skin and Bone is so fucking rad.
It's like people don't even know what it is. Isn't that crazy?
Yeah, Razor King, you know, all that shit.
Man, Razor King. And then they had Fitz, that guy Fitz on keyboards. He played like with Hagar and I think Night Ranger too, but that guy was killer, man. The sound of
the second one, they had Denny Carmassi on drums.
Oh, God. The second one with the sharks cutting through the grass, that album cover.
Right, yeah.
That singer, he's in Robin Trower now, huh?
Yeah, Davey Patterson.
Yeah.
When we played Wolfgang's once, Exodus, back in the early days, and his new band, his post-Gamma band, got booked on it. And like, and me and Tom Hunting are huge fans, right? So we couldn't wait to meet the guy. And we were so disappointed that our crowd was so not nice to him. You know, they were pretty closed off back then. Because, you know, it wasn't like he got up there and he was playing some fucking, like, stupid pop music. He was playing some blues rock, you know, which now we could do that and Exodus could play and everybody walk out and tell him how great it was.
Yeah.
Back then, you know, it wasn't fucking metal. That Exodus and shit. Me and Tom went and apologized to him. We're like, we're really sorry. We're huge fans. And,
I remember he was living in San Rafael and he'd sing like on Thursday nights at this place called the Mayflower.
Yeah,
he'd go down there and sing Irish tunes, dude.
Yeah, yeah, he was living in the Bay Area for quite a while.
Where's he live now, you know?
What's that?
You know where he lives now?
I have no idea. I just know he sings for Trower now, so.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, Andy told me. Andy was playing in a cover band, the Butlers, and I guess they opened for Trower, and he was there. He was talking to him. Yeah. That Gamma shit's incredible. Even Gamma 3 is weird as fuck. They experimented and it just went new wave.
Yeah, they got a little synthesizer heavy. Although the first two albums have that, but they have the rock synths, you know, and people synth solos and shit like that, you know?
Yeah.
But the first two albums are as good as it gets. You know?
Yeah, so good. What, you know, I never knew, and I'm sure it's out there, but why was Paul fired the first time, or did he quit?
He was fired.
Yeah, he was fired.
Yeah.
Why was he fired?
His living situation was pretty dire at the time. He was living in a warehouse, and he was struggling with, like, the new material. He, like, you know, getting the vocals down and stuff. And he was, you know, and, like, you look back. Once again, you know, you can't deal with regret. But, you know, he was kind of a mess, and but when we got back together in the late 90s, we were much bigger messes. Well, we became much bigger messes, but we were bigger messes together.
Wow.
You know, I mean, you know, it's one of those things we just thought it was a move we had to make.
Yeah. Yeah, to get further along, like take it up a couple notches.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, Steve comes in, and then you get Bill Graham management, and you got Toxic Waltz. It's all over MTV. I mean, I saw you guys at the Fillmore on that tour, and it was radical, man.
Yeah, I mean, things went great and, you know, and all that. But, you know, I mean, I guess maybe a lot of it has to do with, like, Paul passing. You know, it's like I have no regrets over any of it. Then it saddens me, you know, that we'll push that. He was such a huge part of the band, you know.
Yeah. I also wanted to ask you this question. When you were out with Slayer, I know I'm good friends with Dave Lombardo, and I know you were great friends with him.
Yeah, of course.
When that thing went down, was that a tough gig to be in this band and you're like, Dave's gone, you know?
Well, you know, it was made less tough because we're getting a guy that I've known for a large chunk of my musical life and have recorded an album with before, Paul.
Right.
But it's kind of one of those things. It was shocking. It's like, you know, I get a call like, Dave's out. What? You know, but, you know, in Slayer, I wasn't a decision maker. It's not my job. And above my pay grade, you know.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, it's different. You know, it'd be a whole different thing if, like, you know, if it happened in a band that, like, I'm a, you know, one of the controlling members of. So yeah, it sucked, you know, because Dave and I, we were like afternoon day off compatriots. You know, we'd go out hunting down kebabs and beers on a summer day off in Germany, you know. But, you know, like I said, I've known Paul, I've recorded with Paul, and so that was an easy adjustment. I mean, Kerry asked me of, like, well, you know, before Paul came back, that John Deddy was doing the Australian dates, and he asked, you want to come down and rehearse? Different drummer. I said, nah.
Yeah.
So you and him are tight. I don't care. You know, I mean, truthfully, I hadn't rehearsed with Slayer in years.
Oh, really?
No, I never go down there.
Wow, really?
I fucking do my homework. You know, if you know the songs and you know them, you're fucking set. As long as you fucking do your studying, you know, it's like studying for a final exam. If you're
right.
Partying and you're hitting the frat parties, you're going to fuck up. If you're fucking hitting the books, you're going to do fine.
Yeah.
As long as Kerry is tight with, be it Dave or the small stint with John Deddy or the years with Paul, I'm fine. Because as long as they're tight, I'm playing to the both of them anyway. So.
What I mean, they couldn't have, there's no other guy they could have got that people, I think fans would have been okay with other than you. You were the guy, man. Like, you know.
I think there's other guys, you know. I'm not that narcissistic to think that I'm the only guy. I mean, yeah, I had like old school cred, so it's not, I don't think they could go and get some young kid. Like, who's this fucking 25-year-old dude? I think there would have been a huge culture shock within the band. I think that was it more than anything, is having to be comfortable and know the guy, you know? And having to be that guy.
Yeah.
No, you know, I was pretty well accepted in the ranks of Slayer fans, but there's always someone like, he fucking doesn't even play Jeff solos. No, I don't. I admit it. No one in the band ever asked me to. And if the band really wanted that, there's a million guys in tribute bands who were nailing every fucking crazy note that Jeff ever played.
Yeah.
And they've been a better fit for that, you know. But, you know, like when I first did it and it was supposed to be a short-term thing, you know, people were like, oh, cool. We got to see, like, you know, Gary put his stamp on it. And that's what I did, you know.
How did you approach the solos on that? Did you actually sit down and write solos or did you just go for it live?
A couple of times I did. After some frustrating moments, I'd like work something out, usually improv. And then I'd like find something I liked and I'd stick to it, you know, and like, and then over the last 2 years, I worked out a solo in Seasons I liked because I was just winging it. And like, and I'd look back at Warren Lee, my guitar tech. And like, if I did a really good job, he'd like, "Woo, that was hot, you know?" And then I'd like doing like, I'd try something different that didn't work. And he'd look at me like, that's but, you know, I tried to keep the vibe there. And a lot of the early stuff, like the Show No Mercy stuff, Jeff had a lot of melody.
Yeah.
And a lot of signature lines, and I tried to keep those. Like, if there's a time when he broke from the on the chaotic fast stuff and put like a written melody in. I tried to keep that there, that or something really similar. But, you know, the band allowed me to do my own thing, you know, because, I mean, I can't play like Jeff. You know, that shit's crazy.
Yeah. You know,
that to, like, Jeff did it naturally. To someone who wants to play like Jeff, that's the guy in the tribute band who's dedicated himself to learning how to play like Jeff, you know, and I'd have to relearn how to be a guitar player to do that shit.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I'm a rock guitar player who, like, plays real fast songs, you know, like, because I grew up on hard rock, and that's what I am, you know. Like, you know, I have an easier time playing Angus solos than Jeff's, because that's where those are my roots, you know.
Yeah, yeah, Priest, KK Downing, stuff
yeah,
like that.
Yeah. Except for that Painkiller solo, Glenn's. I don't want to even ever have to try to do that. It's a crazy solo. Richie nails it, though. Kills it.
Yeah, Richie does, huh? Man, Richie. Oh,
fuck, man. He's one of the fucking most underrated. I mean, you know, everybody knows he's bad as fuck, but he should be, like, out there on fucking flags.
Yeah, and he's a great dude, man.
Badass guitar player. No, he's the best. Super nice. But he's so good.
Just great. Yeah. What are you thinking on well, you guys are getting ready to go do a record? Definitely no touring in the future at all right now.
Don't even know.
Don't even know. Yeah.
It's like people don't understand as far as this coronavirus goes, us musicians have got it the worst.
Yeah. Same with me, you know, comedian.
People are,
yeah.
Like my wife, she's fucking does hair, you know, like. And they just went back. And then other people are going to go back. And, like, gyms and shit will be open for fucking months and months and months before they're ever talking about cramming 500 people, 700, 7,000 people into any venue, sweaty, shoulder to shoulder. It won't happen probably until they have a fucking vaccine.
Absolutely. I think so, too. You know, sporting events. And Vegas opened back up this week, which is really weird to me.
Really weird, yeah.
I mean, I can't imagine being in a casino just huffing that recycled air with thousands of people gambling.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, we're living in a weird time right now, brother. Let's talk a little bit about the Rob Dukes era.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, you know, the interesting thing about Exodus is you have these eras that have kept the machine going.
It's kind of like Spinal Tap when they had the... Yeah, what were the different eras they called it in Spinal Tap?
Oh, the drummer eras?
The Spinal Tap Mark III or whatever. when they did the musical Saucy Jack.
So that
different eras, though. There's different eras. And they're all kick ass, you know?
When you go out on tour, do you play stuff from the Rob era?
Oh, fuck yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, quite a bit, yeah.
Yeah, I haven't seen... favorite
stuff we ever done, so, you know...
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Christ. What happened with him? It just ran its course?
Yeah, just, you know, it's another one of those fucking things where, you know, just things started not gelling like they should, and, you know, decisions were made on by us that, you know, over the way things were going at that particular time. You know, Rob's a very close friend of mine still to this day, and it hurt, and I was kind of like busy out there with Slayer and stuff, and like, and I wasn't around like when we were doing the record and stuff, and there was some conflict on how the album was coming along and stuff, and so we brought Zetro back, and Zetro's been an absolute saint. He's been a different guy, you know, I mean, he's always been a killer singer, it's a fucking thrash metal legend, but there were personality conflicts like galore in the old days, you know, like,
oh really?
But we've learned, you know, that's the thing, you know, you, instead of regretting shit, you learn from it, and like, it might have taken the third go round, but now we're like, we're really close, we're really tight and good friends, you know, like, and in the past, you know, like, there was a time when, like, I didn't think I'd ever get along with a singer not named Paul Baloff, even though I always got along with Rob, but like, then when Rob was out of the band, I was like, fuck, you know, like, what am I doing?
Yeah.
But, you know, Zetro's been fantastic, and I can't wait to work on the new record with him.
Does Steve write the lyrics, or do you write the lyrics?
I write almost everything in the band nowadays.
You do?
Always had, you know, like, see, you know, there'll be some contributions. I hope Lee's got a couple of songs. You know, when I got to write the whole album, that's you know, a lot more riffs. But, you know, it's like usually as long as I can get a two-song contribution out of the other guys, you know, that takes a lot of weight off, you know.
Yeah. Did Bailoff write the lyrics on Bonded by Blood or you?
About half.
Wow.
Maybe a little less than half.
I think that song, And Then There Were None, is a masterpiece, man.
Yeah, it's crushing.
I've said it over and over on this podcast in 8.5 years, Bonded by Blood, the greatest thrash metal record ever made.
I think so.
I mean,
I'm biased as fuck, but I love it. But, you know, I just, you know, there's so many great thrash metal debuts, and I'm not in the slight bit offended, you know, if someone says, you know, I like this, I like Kill 'Em All, I like Show No Mercy, I like fucking, you know, Anthrax, Megadeth, So Far So Good. I mean, P-Cell, sorry.
Yeah.
You know, because they're all killer. They're all fucking killer records, you know, like, but when someone does say Bonded by Blood, yeah, it's a huge honor. You just said it. Charlie Benante says it's the best one, and
it is.
It means the world to me. But I don't go walking around with it in a feather in my cap because I love all these other albums. You know?
Oh, my God. It's so good. I'm glad I got to talk to you because I was bummed when we didn't get to hook up in January.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
But hopefully one day I'll be back out on the road doing comedy and I'll be in Sacramento.
Yeah,
You can come to the show.
And yeah, absolutely.
We can do like a part two, you know?
Yeah, for sure. Anytime.
You like living in Sacramento?
I do. You know, I like the hot weather because, you know, once again, going back to being old with all bad joints and knees and stuff, you know, the hot, dry climate's really good for me. You know, 2 out of 3 kids live here. My grandkids live here. You know, I miss the Bay Area. My wife really misses the Bay Area.
Yeah.
And, you know, we might eventually at some point, like, migrate back, you know, but costs and prices fucking exorbitant, you know.
It's crazy.
My oldest lives in Burbank, you know, so.
Oh, yeah. Wow. How old's your oldest?
28.
Wow. You got a 28-year-old.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I'm old, man.
I am, too. I'm 54.
No, you're young. You're still 2 years behind me, my friend.
Yeah. You ever get any fears of death, man? I get that lately.
You know, I never have, not even during all this shit. But, you know, I get some, like I said, you know, like as I got older, all of a sudden, what's this fucking feeling I got? Oh, it's this thing I've heard about called anxiety.
Yeah.
I've never fucking had an anxiety, even a minor palpitation anxiety attack in my life until fucking in my 50s.
Yeah.
Fucking weird. Maybe it's just I was so carefree about shit.
Yep.
Before that, I didn't fucking open my mind up enough to worry about anything because I was just fucking didn't give a shit, you know?
Yeah.
But, you know, I got grandkids now and the world's fucking gone mad and I don't know what the future holds for anybody.
And now
I don't know what it holds for me.
Yeah. You
know,
like, yeah.
My oldest, you know, she's an animator at Nickelodeon. Unfortunately, she's been able to work from home this whole time.
But she got a great gig, huh?
Yeah, she's got a great gig, yeah. She's moving over to Warner Brothers next job.
I keep saying animation's going to be bigger than ever now because people can just do the voiceovers at home and the other people draw it and you don't have to be around people.
She's the storyboard artist.
Yeah, that's cool.
Super proud of her. You know, so, yeah, I don't know what's going on. You know, it's fucking crazy.
Are you a stand-up comedy guy before I get out of here?
Yeah, I mean, not like Rob Dukes was. Rob would sit on, you know, by himself on the bus and just listen to, like, stand-up. And he'd start cracking up, and I'd say, what's so funny? And then he'd put it on, and I'm, like, cracking up. So, yeah, you know, it's like, I do like it. I like comedy. I like the laugh. We need more of it nowadays.
I know.
I need to watch. I need to, like, when I'm not playing guitar, to, like, put on some good comedy and stop watching the fucking news.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I feel that's almost irresponsible to, like, not stay abreast on what's going on out there. And then you get the other side saying, oh, you're just falling in, listening to the media's lies and shit. But, you know, I'll trust my own eyes. You know, I want to know what's going on out there, you know.
I think the number one thing is, man, it's just – if everybody, and as stupid hippie as it sounds, if everybody could just like come together, man, and it's wild that they can't do that. You know, even during the coronavirus time, where people were just like, fuck that, it's fake or whatever, they couldn't even like lend a hand to somebody that's sick and dying, you know?
Yeah, I blame the internet on half that kind of shit, because, you know, you just have mass access to disinformation, you know? Like,
yeah,
you didn't used to have that, you know? I miss the day when there was no social media. I mean, I could live without it.
Yeah.
Here I am on Instagram and got like 280,000 followers, and I miss the days when I fucking had none.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's a double-edged sword, and I've talked about it over and over.
Yeah, it is a double-edged sword.
I hate it, and I also love it. I love like opening up Instagram and seeing your, you know, flying V yesterday. That kind of stuff makes me happy, you know?
Yeah. Well, you know, that's why on my page, I never post shit about religion or politics.
Yeah.
I'd rather have everybody just commenting, going, killer guitar, or great that you got to see your grandkids, or fucking, haha, that was funny as fuck, happy Catterday, then fucking it just fucking turn into some all-out internet war over fucking nothing.
Yeah.
There's enough pages for that. And that's where I'm like, if that's what people want, they can go somewhere else for it. I'm just going to post cat memes.
Yeah.
Okay, we need more cat memes.
It's great talking to you, man. I've loved your playing my whole life. You're one of the greatest riff writers of all time. You are the blueprint of the greatest thrash metal record, and it's so great to just look at this kind of shit right here.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, your high school yearbook, basically.
Day on the Dirt, dude. Come on. That's
right there. Yep.
Day on the Dirt, dude.
It was our Day on the Green.
Yeah, I loved it. I loved it.
Yeah, totally.
Anyway, this will be out Monday in like 2 days. So cool. If you have anything you want to say, like, or you got nothing to promote, we got nothing to promote.
Nothing to promote.
But. Yeah, but looking forward to hearing the new record. And I can't wait to see you up in Sacramento, man.
Cool. And I'll see you in a little while.
All right. Thank you. Thank you so much.
I'll talk to you later, dude.
See you, brother.
All right. Bye-bye.
Later.
Bye.